Welcome to the Vet Podcast by the vet gurus, Brendan and Mark. Get ready for the latest veterinary news, information and entertainment. Don't forget to visit us at the Vet Gurus website, vetgurus.com. Now, sit back, relax. It's over to the Vet Gurus, Brendan and Mark.
Welcome. Brendan here with Mark, the Vet Gurus, episode 341. I think I made a bit of a mess the last episode number, Mark, but it's all good. This is definitely 341, Thursday, April the 4th, 2024, Mark. And it is, well, sort of the end of Easter period here, isn't it, in our few days off. And Easter's a really the most popular, I think you know this, Mark, the most popular period, so particularly people have 5 to 6 days off. There's a Friday and a Monday and the Saturday. A lot of people take off if they normally work on Saturday. And then we get people taking an extra day or two off either side, Mark. And it's the most popular day in Australia for people to get out and go camping, isn't it?
It is indeed. And with good reason. The weather is generally horrible.
Exactly. I was going to say that. What usually happens is it's everybody, they go there once a year camping or their first time camping, and all the camping sites are taken and all the caravan, you know, park type situations, and then it usually absolutely pelts down rain, or there's huge storms, or there's a cyclone or something. Having said that, I don't know about up your way, Mark, but it's been quite good, the weather. And today's the day that the weather's changed. And typically, and we're recording early in the week, towards the end of that Easter holiday period, most people are heading back home, Mark, to start work again in a day or two. So I think they've been lucky this year. But it's just inevitably there's always some crazy, you know, rain period, isn't there, during the Easter break?
And it's axiomatic for the Easter break that there's got to be a thunderstorm that wets everyone's camping gear.
Yes, yes. So there we go. And I'm sure you're used to that up where you still are up north, Mark. Lots of mold, precipitation, and lots of mold. Yes. Yeah. What? Well, let me quiz you on something. Do you have to worry about any fungus getting in your lenses and your camera equipment? Is it a concern?
Oh, it's a big concern. And it's not like, you know, the computer, the microphones and things that we use for the podcast, all the electronic stuff is vulnerable. I do have a little spot in our accommodation where we have a couple of moisture absorbing buckets to try and keep the humidity down, and we have a fan to keep the air moving so it doesn't sit in that area, and that's where I keep the lenses, but yeah, it is a real serious potential problem, and so yeah, I worry a lot about it. But what are you going to do, Brendan? You're in the best spot in the world to take photos. You're not going to bring your camera because it might get a bit moldy.
So Do you use those moisture absorbing crystals or balls or whatever?
Yeah.
Do you use reusable ones? Do you have the ones? Because some of them you can
cook.
Yeah, you put them in the oven and it gets obviously cooks out the moisture and that turns and the fancier ones turn colour, don't they? They turn a colour back to the colour indicating that they're okay to go again.
Yeah. No. These ones are exactly like that, but there is so much humidity in the air that they just end up, your colour doesn't matter, they're just in a big puddle of water that they've absorbed, and so we do cook them up, but it's almost, they're so freely available. They're one of the things that's probably cheaper up here, you know, being remote, most of the things in the supermarket are more expensive, but the little bags of dehydrating crystals to keep your stuff dry, they're a little bit less expensive. So I take advantage of that.
Yes. Do you wrap them around your head to try and get rid of your brain fog, or it doesn't help with that?
I've tried it and it doesn't help. It's still just as foggy.
Well, That's weather, Mark. What have we got? I think you went up to check.
I was going to ask you because you've got a big trip coming up in the near future, and I wanted to ask you. You'll be on the plane for 11 hours, and I was very interested to know how you cope with how do you occupy your time?
Well, I think the older you get, Mark. Well, with me, the older I get, the time goes quicker, and you're not as agitated and as antsy. So I think that part of it's that compared with doing long flights 10, 20, 30 years ago, Mark. Because by the time you just sort of pace yourself, by the time you know they're up in the air, they're up at cruising height, you've usually served something, potter around, watch a film or two, and you know, some of the films these days are, what, 3 hours, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then I usually take my laptop on as carry-on. You know, don't want to risk it in the hold there, and I've always got things to do on there, and I'll probably be going over my little notes I'll be doing for the course I'm helping present, which we'll chat about when I get back, Mo. So yeah, it sort of goes by. It goes by fairly quickly, and
When I do these, I always have like an expectation that this is time I'm trapped. I'm going to use it productively for this purpose.
Yep.
And I invariably fail abysmally to be anything close to productive.
And you just waste. But that's fine. That's fine. You seem to waste time and you end up pottering around, or you look up something or an article.
Watch a movie.
Yeah. Crossword, whatever. And, yeah, having said that, sometimes you get to that sort of point where you think, oh, how long have we got to go? And you look and you think, oh, God, 5 hours to go or whatever. And then it drags for that hour or so. And then before you know it, you think, oh, we'll be landing soon. And have I got all my stuff together? And have I got my little, you know, customs form filled out correctly? And, oh, where's my passport? I can't find it, you know, all that sort of stuff. So, yeah. No, but all good, yeah. I think we're used to it much more than most people in the world, aren't we? Because it's usually a hell of a long way to travel anywhere from Australia internationally.
If we're going from Australia, it's going to be a long trip.
Whereas those lucky people in Europe or USA, it's in Canada, etc., it's not far to head over to Europe and vice versa, is it? It's only a few hours. So I think they're spoiled, Mark, these long trips. I do have a bit of a layover. I'm flying via Sydney, and so that's another 90 minutes, and then I've got to get to the airport here, and it's going to be a good 14, 16 hours, Mark, this leg.
It'll be a long day, Brendan.
But, I'm ready. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be a fun trip, and we'll chat about it when I get back, Mark.
Hey, Brendan, when we got an email from our wonderful regular correspondent, Nick, concerning our episode about the legal challenges with exotic pets, what did you think of what he said?
Yes, I thought it was good. Now you're going to have to pull it up. I'm trying to find.
Well, I'll tell you that you pull it up, and I'll tell you that there were two important things that he mentions that I thought we were remiss for not mentioning. The first one, and we might even do a podcast on this, we were mainly talking about the legality, but Nick mentions the danger that, you know, whether they're venomous reptiles or reptiles that are dangerous for other reasons, they might be a good reason to recommend to our, at that same staff meeting we talked about where we have this discussion about what our practice policy is going to be. Having a discussion about those aspects as well, because there are maybe not necessarily the same legal concerns, but definitely occupational health and safety here in Australia would be very keen that we have a policy in place to deal with venomous reptiles that might be brought to the hospital. So
yes,
I was particularly keen that he mentioned that. The other thing that was interesting was he points out that we mentioned that each jurisdiction has its own laws, and in where he is, vets aren't obligated to report illegal animals. And additionally, there's very little resources for the Department of Natural Resources, who are the enforcement body. They don't have much in the way of resources to enforce these laws. And most of what happens if civilians don't have a license and they do have illegal animals, the animals may be confiscated, but then they're often put into permanent foster care, and those foster carers are under a huge amount of pressure, and the animals may, you know, the wildlife rescue centre may have be overrun with animals. And he mentions the box turtles that aren't legally allowed to be released.
Sounds frustrating, doesn't it, Mark?
It does. It's definitely a no-win situation.
He's trying to do the right thing, and he sees them going into a confiscated correctly, but going into a less than ideal halfway house, and then they may suffer there or end up no further and not have a reward in life, if that makes sense. Yeah, so that was a really interesting comment there, and also highlighted the bit about the making sure that you have clinic wide policies, and you chat to the staff, as you suggested, that they it's clear, you know, what you will see and what you won't see. Having said that, and I think he touched on that as well, you can still get people lobbing up with these illegal pets, Mark, and you need to provide emergency care for them and pain relief, etc., when they are seriously ill. So it is a headache, but it is, and I think, you know, and Nick's reply sort of at the outset mentioned that it's something that we often don't think about, and those vets and clinics who are dealing with exotic pets, unusual pets, need to address it, Mark, because they may not have come across it yet, but they will.
They definitely will.
Well, that's our news, Mark. I've got a couple of news articles that I'm holding off for our next episode. So I think we'll jump into the main topic, and it's a birdie one, Mark. And this is quite of an interesting one. So I'm really, really, really looking forward to this. And that's your spin on what we know and what we don't know, even more so about feeding one of our cockatoo species, our cockatiels, Mark. And,
yes.
And cockatiels they're an extremely popular pet worldwide, aren't they?
They are, and they've probably reached the point where they've been in captivity sufficiently long that we would consider them a domesticated species, and they're very desirable. They're interactive birds. They're of a size that makes handling them okay, and they're, you know, if you look on the web, there's huge numbers of sites where they talk or sing, or the way they interact makes them excellent pets. So they're very, very popular. You are right.
Yes. So let's jump into it, Mark. And we have previously, we have done a couple of podcasts where we've chatted about generalities with avian nutrition, Mark, but we're going to focus on feeding cockatiels, Mark. So, yeah, and especially I want to hear about the what we don't know, which is fascinating considering they are such a popular pet and have been for a very long time, Mark. So what have you got for us?
Well, I was going to say I like that phrase, we don't know what we don't know, and it's interesting to give a little bit of an idea that the species we know most about nutritionally are poultry, because nutrition plays a critical role in the financial success of poultry production. If they can manage feed conversion a bit better, then that makes the enterprise that much more profitable. So we know a lot about poultry nutrition. Probably next on the hierarchy of species in which we know a bit about nutrition is humans. We know a lot about human nutrition, unsurprising because of the effect it's likely to have on human health. But I always like to point out to my clients that if you were to take a book that was 1,000 pages long, and that was, you know, the volume that talked about poultry or human nutrition. The same book that talked about cockatiel nutrition would be just one page long. There's 1,000 times more information about those aforementioned species than there is about cockatiels. And while there's a few papers, there's really only there's more papers published in any given year on poultry than the cumulative total of knowledge about cockatiels. And so the consequence of that is that if you ask people that I would consider experts what you should feed your cockatiel, you will get different answers. And the reason for that is that each of us, each person who likes to provide some advice about what to feed cockatiels is providing the best they can, but they're making some assumptions because we don't know exactly what is best.
So why, Mark, why do you think there's so little research on the nutrition of the cockatiel?
It's bucks, Brendan. The long and the short of it is that there's not a lot of money in it. Someone has to foot the bill for the research. And when it comes down to poultry versus cockatiels, it's a no-brainer. People are going to make money out of research that goes into poultry. There's very little money to be made out of the research that goes into cockatiels. And interestingly enough, this sort of is a bit of a soapbox thing for me, because, and we're talking specifically about cockatiels today, we have talked generically about parrot nutrition in other contexts before, but there's nearly 370 species of parrots worldwide. And, you know, if you looked closely enough, if you studied them closely enough, the nutritional requirements and the patterns of nutritional metabolism for each of those species is likely to be different. And for some of them, we know literally nothing, and we're extrapolating from what we do know, whether it's poultry or the research that has been done on cockatiels. We often extrapolate from that to the species we know less about. But yeah, we really are working on a threadbare cupboard of knowledge when it comes to recommendations for what to feed cockatiels.
Yes. So you wanted to touch on a particular study or studies, Mark, that does have a little bit of about information about what wild cockatiels eat.
Well, it's a little bit of a it's a very interesting study. Jones in 1987 published an article which over a couple of years they looked at cockatiels in Moree, and what they in Moree's a town in northern central New South Wales. It is a big farming area, and they were actually sort of trying to make a bit of an assessment about how much damage the birds were doing to crops. And so they did have an extended opportunity to look at the birds, catch some of the birds regularly, do crop washes and look at exactly what they had been eating. They were observing them in the field, and some of their findings are probably a little bit surprising, I suppose. Those cockatiels that were observed over a couple of years ate about 60% of their diet was sorghum, the main crop in that area. And sorghum is a distant relative of millet. And the birds probably consumed well over half their diet was sorghum. Now, sunflower was grown in that area as well, Brendan, and they could have fed like quite copiously. I know several of the captive birds that I know will eat sunflower seed exclusively, But these wild birds only consumed a little bit over 5% of their diet was sunflower seed. 20% of their diet were native grasses, Phalaris and Setaria predominantly, and 14% of the diet was various other herbages and seeds and whatever they could get from the wild. So it's not as complicated a wild diet as you would imagine. Now, you have to keep in mind that while that's a total, a cumulative total over the, you know, the time they were looking at these birds, there were seasonal changes. So the birds would eat higher energy foods while they were reproductively active. They would seek out protein-rich supplements to the sorghum when they were reproductively active. So there was some seasonality to it. But yeah, it's a pretty interesting observation of their wild nutrition.
It's good that there's at least something out there. So based on that and the other limited studies out there, Mark, what let's get to the point. What's the current recommendations? What do we recommend as the ideal or the best diet to feed pet cockatiels, mate?
Well, I think the take-home message, the, you know, the headline, the clickbait, if you like, is that for most birds, for most pet birds, we're going to recommend a high proportion of the diet should be good quality formulated foods, pelleted foods. There are a large number of these now. But cockatiels are one of the exceptions. I would recommend, maybe for other species, 80% of the intake by weight should be a high-quality pelleted food. I don't think this is a good thing for most cockatiels. I think these desert species do not do well on the formulated diets for a variety of reasons. And pelleted foods, formulated foods, should make up some of the diet, but less than 50% of the diet for cockatiels.
Yep.
And they should eat seeds like they do in the wild. And I don't think you'll often find here in Australia, you'll often find what is just labelled parrot mix. And that's a bunch of seeds that is relatively high in energy, relatively large seeds, and relatively the very opposite of what the cockatiels would eat in the wild. So I would not give them parrot seed. I would give them maybe canary mix or budgerigar mix, those seeds that are largely based on French white seed mixes, which are largely based on French white millet and then have a variety of other small seeds. And that mimics the you know, the sorghum that they are attracted to. That combination is what I would generally recommend that they get maybe 45% of their diet from pellets, 45% high quality canary mix seed diet, and then the balance can be a mixture of vegetables, of healthy vegetables. And I make a little bit of a list of the veggies that I, so the first thing to say about those additional foods outside of the seed and pellets is that cockatiels don't eat fruit. So don't be offering them, you know, in the wild, they eat no fruit whatsoever. So don't be offering them things like bananas or apples or oranges. These are fruits that are rich in fruit sugars and certainly not the sort of thing they've been evolved to digest. But they have been and they do like herbage in the wild and a mixture of things like beans and peas, a small amount of those legumes, dark leafy greens are always good. A little bit of corn, starchy though it is good. Grated carrot and sweet potato, and pumpkin for its pigment and its fiber. And we also add, we call them capsicums here in Australia, but bell peppers, as they're known in other parts of the world, chilies, and a little bit of beetroot are all suitable things to add as vegetables to the cockatiel's diet.
Excellent. Now, there's a good list there, Mark. Just going back one step, you mentioned the commercial pellets. You wanted to make a comment about one of the products, but also, are there any particular brands that you think are that you'd recommend, not over others, or not?
Look, I think the good. I do have a lot of respect for the research that the Rowdy Push company have put into their foods. I really value those foods. Lefebvre, who do a lot of work for education of exotic veterinarians, but also produce some wonderful foods. Here in Australia, we have the Vetifarm products, and they're a good, solid, middle-of-the-road value for money pelleted food. But the rule still applies that I wouldn't let any of those foods, however good I think of them, comprise more than about half the bird's intake. And it's interesting, there are health consequences. There's well recognized, particularly there's some renal damage leading to polyuria associated with pelleted diets. And there are even some lines of cockatiels who seem much more susceptible to this effect. And I don't know that the mechanism of action has been fully elucidated. I know that there was some research, David Phelan had done some research which suggested that high levels of calcium in some of the pellets exceeded the cockatiel's kidney's ability to deal with it and resulted in damage to the collecting tubules, and that's how they became polyuric. There are some other theories about how that might work. But if anyone's feeding, even if you're less than 50% and the birds become polyuric, that is, they start to produce excessive amounts of urine, watery droppings, then stop the pellets straight away, because some cockatiels have almost an idiosyncratic reaction to metabolites in the pelleted foods that cause problems for their kidneys.
Interesting. Very interesting. Now, fat cockatiels, Mark.
Fat cockatiels. One of the things that I think is pretty important is that, as I said before, some of our captive domesticated cockatiels will become almost obsessed with sunflower seeds or even nuts that are added to some of the parrot foods. Now, I don't make an absolute ban on these things, but I do think that they must be kept to a bare minimum. And I recommend to my clients that those things, sunflower seed and finely chopped nuts, are used as training rewards, as tools to train the birds and often to encourage them to have a go at maybe some environmental enrichment. It's interesting that the daily intake, that particular study in Moree identified that most of those cockatiels were consuming about 14 grams, a bit less than a tablespoon of feed a day. And our captive birds, who don't have to fly very far, will definitely eat much more than that. And if they eat, you know, a couple of tablespoons of sunflower seed, that's going to represent like a huge over indulgence in caloric intake. So I really think, you know, four or five sunflower seeds is the upper limit of their daily intake for those, and they should be reserved as treats or rewards for appropriate behaviour.
Yes, and I think also there's the issue of people feeding those pelleted diets with any bird, Mark, where you ask them how much pelleted food are they feeding, and they'll shrug their shoulders and say, I don't know, I just fill up the bowl. So good, I think it's important that we, you know, and I think you often mention to clients based on the particular species. And the particular diet that's been fed, the brand that's been fed, feed X grams of that per day. And once they've eaten that amount for the 24-hour period, even if they eat it fairly quickly, nothing more for the next 23 hours.
You're exactly right, Brendan. I think the concept of a daily ration and even a meal-by-meal ration, I think that's a really important thing for pet birds. I know we've sort of have a culture here in Australia of these gigantic feed bowls that are just filled with some, you know, essentially shovels, and the birds the diet that goes into those bowls might be 45% seed, 45% pellets, and but the birds might be selecting out no pellets and all of the worst seeds possible. So only feeding them what they'll eat in a day and ensuring that they eat all the ration before they get the next dose, that's a really good thing to do. Good point, Brendan.
Yes. Oh, thank you. That's something you taught me. Any sort of final comments, Mark, about feeding cockatiels? There's some great advice.
The final one is weigh them. Use those. One of the things to do with the treats when you're trying to train them to do things is to train them to stand on a set of scales. And I reckon you learn so much from just getting the bird to sit on the scales once a week. You don't necessarily want to do it every day because you can become a bit obsessed,
yes,
like I am, with my weight. If you're doing it once a week, and then you see a trend where the bird is losing weight, then obviously you can up their portion size and allow them to hang on to a little bit. If you do that and they continue to lose weight, then obviously that's an indication for a visit to your local avian exotic veterinarian. But, yeah, I think whenever we talk about diets, the corollary of that is making sure you weigh the bird so that the appropriate diet is producing the appropriate outcome.
Yes. Very clear and concise point there, Mark. Well, I think with that, we better get weighing our birds, being careful with those pellets and adding more of those veggies that are ideal for them, Mark. And we need somebody to get out there and do some more studies, don't we?
As we always say, there's so much to learn, so much research to be done.
And we'll talk to you all next week. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Vet Podcast by the Vet Gurus. Don't forget to visit us at the website vetgurus.com, where you can subscribe, view show notes, listen to previous episodes and more. You can contact us via email at vetgurus@gmail.com to ask a question or just say hi. Thanks again and see you next time.